You ready to proceed?
Yes.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Silverman. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. We have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal so that the court is aware of that. The appeal has been focused upon three grounds. The first ground is that the trial court failed to grant summary judgment where there were no genuine issues of material fact. The second ground for the appeal is that the trial court committed error when it vacated the default judgment that had been entered over a year earlier in the declaratory judgment action, which is the action that brings us here before the court. The third ground for the appeal is that there was an error of law and fact by the trial court when it ruled that the independent agent, that notice to an independent agent of a lawsuit was in fact notice to the carrier, which as I trust the court is aware, is not part of the words contained within the policy. The policy is what is at issue in this particular litigation, because ultimately what was filed in this case was a declaratory judgment action. The declaratory judgment action was filed by the appellant, and in that there was an allegation, or the allegations were that there was a material breach of the terms and conditions of the policy by its underlying insured, which eliminated the indemnity. In other words, eliminated coverage for any loss. Specifically because the carrier for the appellant was prejudiced by the conduct of its own insured. In order to review that analysis, any recitation of this case would have to include a recitation of some of the procedural history and some of the factual history that occurred in order to bring us to this point.
Well, the lawsuit that's the subject of this appeal is the coverage case, is that correct?
That is accurate.
But there was an underlying litigation, and that resulted in a, after all was said and done, a money judgment against some of the defendants?
That is accurate. It resulted in a money judgment against the appellant's underlying insured, Jimmy's Grill or the restaurant.
Okay. And that judgment has not been upset. That's a final judgment?
That is a final judgment on the books, and it remains.
So what we're talking about is the liability of the carrier to cover that judgment.
That is
money
exactly.
Judgment, and to conduct the defense.
Not to conduct the defense, but to pay the indemnity for the restaurant that resulted in the underlying judgment.
All right.
And I'll just about get to that, because any recitation of this case and the declaratory judgment action that results in the instant appeal, we would have to discuss what happened below.
Well, I understand that you're going to come to that, but in essence, the argument is based upon the theory that the agency agreement between the insurance agent and the carrier was an acknowledgement by the carrier that the insurance agent could receive and would then appropriately forward notice of suit to the carrier. And a jury resolved a factual issue, didn't it, about whether or not the insurance agent actually received notice?
The jury did resolve the latter question.
So the legal question is, was the trial court's reasoning sound when the trial judge concluded that that agency relationship was an acknowledgement by the carrier that the agent was there to receive service of process on behalf of the carrier from any insured that brought them notice, but did not, in accordance with the terms of the insurance policy, give notice directly to the carrier? That's the heart of the case, isn't it?
I do believe, Chief Justice, that is one of the main issues on appeal. Specifically, and perhaps we are stating the same thing, and I'm just stating it a little bit differently, which is, was the trial court's ruling correct when the trial court ruled that the independent agent, that notice to the independent agent was sufficient of notice to the carrier for the purposes of satisfying the terms and conditions of the policy? And I think we have just stated the same thing a little bit differently.
Yeah, well, do you think that the trial judge's ruling was based on the policy or just based on an ad hoc view that if the agent got notice, given the agency contract with the carrier, that that should be good enough for the carrier to be deemed to have received notice. Did the trial judge really focus on the policy at all between the insured and the carrier?
I did not understand the trial judge to have focused on the policy. I believe the trial judge instead focused on an ad hoc analysis.
It's almost like a constructive notice argument. Let's forget about the policy and the obligation on the insured. Constructively, through the agent, because of the agency agreement, the carrier, after all, should be construed to have gotten notice. Isn't that really what the trial judge was saying?
I do believe so. I do believe that is
now,
right.
Now, where is that wrong as a matter of Delaware law? Tell me that.
It is wrong as a matter of Delaware law because it's a violation of the terms and conditions of what should be read as a fairly simple contract. There's no ambiguity in the contract. The contract is relatively clear on the subject. And then one would have to wonder, well, why is this provision in the contract so important? Why can't we just give notice to an independent agent or maybe give notice to a particular doctor who does some independent examinations for the company? Or why don't we give notice to a lawyer who might from time to time be retained by the company, by the carrier for a particular reason? And that's exactly the essence of this case. The policy has that provision in it, and it calls exactly for notice to the carrier, notice to us is what the exact words in the contract are, to avoid exactly the situation that brings us here today. Exactly the situation that brings us here today. Because the carrier has to have control over what they get and what they don't get for obvious reasons, and I'd be happy to state the obvious.
Well, before you do that, does the carrier have a cause of action against the agent for failing to pass along the notice?
In my personal opinion, the answer is yes.
Okay, and that's, I assume, because they had an expectation that the agent would conduct himself in a proper manner, so in the best interest of the carrier, and give them notice of a claim against the carrier, right?
That is accurate, and it's a very interesting question because the agent is already on record by the Debbie Flood affidavit that's part of the materials by saying, we've never received anything from Jimmy Tanifas or Jimmy's Grill, the underlying insured or otherwise known as the restaurant. Obviously, if their position is they've never received anything, it stands to reason they've never passed anything along. Once the jury came back and concluded that notice was given by the restaurant to the agent is, my words, and pardon the slang, but on the hook in the sense of they're already on record as saying we've never given anything to the carrier. So I do believe, in my personal opinion, that analysis is entirely correct.
Let's see if I understand this. There's an insurance contract between the restaurant and the carrier.
Correct, sir.
That contract requires notice to us, meaning the carrier.
Exactly.
Did that notice to us clause also give a specific address or location where notice had to be given, or did it just say notify the carrier?
That particular clause says, as part of the terms and conditions of the policy, you've got to give notice to us. If you look at...
So us could be us at our home office or us through an agent. It's ambiguous, isn't it?
I do not believe it is. When you look at the... when you get a policy of insurance, no different than one that you, Justice, might have for your automobile insurance, it's fairly clearly defined when you look at the entirety of the policy.
In a vacuum, it might be clear, but there's a second contract out there, isn't there, between the agent and the carrier?
There is.
And that contract calls for the agent to notify Old Guard, the carrier, of any notice of claims it receives. Now,
exactly.
Doesn't that somewhat different notice clause create an ambiguity that a jury would have to resolve?
Well, there's a lot of good questions in there. First of all, the jury was never given the opportunity to resolve that particular issue because the court decided as a matter of law that the independent agent was sufficient. Notice to the independent agent was sufficient for notice to the carrier. And as part of the court's question there, the court should understand that this is not an agent who is at all times an agent of this particular carrier or the appellant in this case. This is an independent agent who writes coverages for many different companies. Now, it's different than perhaps Allstate. Allstate has their own agents set up. If I come to Allstate with, if I've been sued as a result of an automobile accident, and I come to my Allstate agent, who is a direct agent for the company, perhaps that analysis is a lot different. This is an independent agent, and the document that the court just made reference to, which is the agency agreement, pretty clearly spells out what they are an agent for and what they are not an agent for. And what it tells us, right in the first paragraph of that document, it says, you are an agent for the purposes of binding coverages. My words, not exactly in the contract, but that's contextual. For the remainder of it, it says you are an independent contractor. It then has some, as the court is alluding to, it then has some other terms and conditions and says, among other things, if you get notice of a lawsuit, you've got to let us know about it. But that's not putting the independent agent out there for all the world to see and say, we are an agent of the carrier, so don't worry about the terms and conditions of your policy, because the crux of your question, Justice, is that doesn't that essentially create an agency relationship? The answer, if I may, is no. The reason that is the answer is because the agency agreement is between the carrier and its independent agent. The individual insured, in this case the restaurant, would never know about that. The only thing they know about is their policy of insurance with the carrier.
Well, as I understand what the trial judge was relying upon when the trial judge ruled that there is significance to the language in the agency agreement that applies to the insured, even though there is no reason for the insured not to follow the terms of the insured's own policy in terms of giving notice. And the reason is, as I understand it, and this is why I ask you, how is this rooted in Delaware law? The reason, as I understand it, is that that language in the agency agreement is an acknowledgement on the part of the carrier that most insureds just believe that their agent is the company with whom they're insured, and they give notice to their agent. It's where they pay their premium. It's where they review their policy provisions. They don't think in terms of the greater institution out there, the carrier itself. Even in an independent agent that services many different distinct companies. So that, as I understand it, the trial judge was saying, look, you know that a number of your insureds will give notice to the agent and not directly to you, no matter how you spell it out in the policy. So that acknowledgement is that you should have your agents trained, ready, willing, and able to give you prompt notice. Now a jury has found out, or a jury has concluded, that this agent did get notice. And if it didn't get passed on to the carrier, so what? Now, why is that wrong as a matter of Delaware law? Where did the trial judge go wrong?
I think that analysis is a correct analysis, because I think we all have to acknowledge that that does happen from time to time, but that doesn't obviate the need to follow what is the essence of the relationship, the terms and conditions of the policy.
I think we all know that, and I think we all know that you don't need to explain to us why those conditions are in the policy, because you can't investigate a claim if you don't have prompt notice. Mm-hmm. We all know about that. We've all been there, or most of us. So tell me the Delaware case that says this trial judge analysis is inconsistent with Delaware law. Tell us the public policy with which it's inconsistent and why we should reverse the trial judge's ruling.
Very well. With respect to the cases, in looking through Delaware, we have not come up with a case that is exactly on point for this particular subject. I can tell you that there are fairly significant public policy reasons as to why the trial judge was incorrect. And when you look at this case and what happened in the totality of circumstances here that belie this case and the procedural morass that was in this case, I think you have to come to the conclusion that the trial judge made an error when she made that ruling. And I'll submit to you that, picking up on Justice Berger's comments, that would that lead to some liability with respect to the agent? My opinion of that is yes. I note to you that the agent was not brought into this case when, before this declaratory judgment action was ever filed, my adversary knew that the agent's position was, we never got anything. Obviously, we've never passed anything along. The liability would begin and end there. That's the issue in the case, because, again, and I'll get back to the court's question, terms and conditions of the policy were clear. Now, with respect to public policy, you really start to get into a line drawing problem here, that which agent is a good enough agent to give notice to for the purposes of binding coverage. And that's what I started to talk about is anecdotally. Perhaps I do, I have a number of cases for this particular carrier. And let's say somebody wants to give me notice of a lawsuit. Is giving notice to me good enough for giving notice to the carrier? Let's say there's a particular doctor that the carrier retains from time to time in order to do their independent evaluations. Is giving notice to the doctor good enough to give notice to the carrier? What you get into is a pretty slippery slope and a line drawing problem, and I think that is what the trial court failed to look at when the trial court ruled that, well, giving notice to these folks at the independent agent was good enough to give notice to the carrier when you look at the facts and circumstances that were inside this particular case.
Do you want to continue? Do you want to reserve the rebuttal you requested?
I would like to, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ronald Stoner. I represent the defendants in this matter. I'd like to introduce William Earhart, a member of the Delaware Bar. He was the trial counsel in the trial in October on this issue, and Evelyn Cummings, who is the one of the defendants in this matter. Good morning. As you read through the pleadings, Mr. Silverman's client, Mr. Silverman, have raised three issues with the court, and from the argument that I've heard of thus far, the court seems to be focusing on the issue of the notice issue, and certainly that's the matter that went to trial. And the judge's ruling, in our opinion, is based on a sound review of the evidence, clear understanding of the issues. There were a number of pleadings, a number of hearings before Judge Del Pesco in this matter. And she developed, as you can see in some of the transcripts, a pretty clear understanding of this case, and I think at some point got tired of seeing us in front of her. But ultimately, as discovery progressed on this, some interesting issues came forward.
Well, Mr. Stoner,
yes,
the master insurance agreement between the insurer and the insured required that notice of a claim be given to the insurer, correct?
The agreement between Jimmy's Grill and the insurance company says that the company must be notified.
Why then was it appropriate, as a legal matter, for notice of the underlying claim here to be given to the agent rather than directly to the insurer?
For several reasons, sir. Number one, there was testimony from the claims adjuster for the plaintiff. His name was John McGow. In his deposition testimony and subsequently in his trial testimony, he indicated that he was aware of a previous personal injury claim presented to the carrier that came through the agent, Callaway Fernell & Moore, involving this exact same restaurant, Jimmy's Grill. And in his testimony, he indicated that he guessed that that's how they had gotten notice, that they had gotten notice from the agent, Callaway. The second is the practice, which was testified to by Jimmy Tenafas, who is the operator of Jimmy's Grill. Mr. Tenafas testified that his practice when he received these documents for litigation was to take them to Callaway Fernell & Moore, the agent. That certainly makes sense given the location of the restaurant in Bridgeville and the insurance agent being in Seaford.
Did the insurer defend when notice was given in that form?
In the other personal injury case, that's
yes.
Correct. It's my understanding.
So there is a record that establishes that this very insured had given notice to this same agent in the past, and it had been timely, and the carrier had stepped in and offered a defense and ultimately indemnified in a specific instance in the past. Is that what you're telling me?
No, there's too many variables in there, Chief Justice.
Well, all of them were assumed in your answer to Justice Jacobs' question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, then I misspoke. What my understanding was from the testimony of John McGowan, and for the court's purposes, we did not go into detail to that other personal injury action since it did not involve my client.
Yeah, the information about it came from the same person that maintained that he was the owner, only to admit later that, in fact, he was not the owner of Jennings Cove.
Actually, it came from the insurance claims adjuster, John McGowan, and that allowed us to explore further through Jimmy Tenenbaum's.
The claims adjuster was aware of other claims against Jimmy's Grill that were defended by the carrier?
Yes, he discussed it in his deposition that he guessed that that's how they had received notice of it, from the agent Callaway.
Okay.
In addition, there was the testimony from Jimmy Tenenbaum that he had presented those litigation documents routinely to the agent Callaway from an
Well, that Law. Was my question. He's the same guy that said he was the owner and then admitted later he was not, correct?
In a general sense, yes. He's the same guy. Yeah, that's true, Your Honor. The issue with the ownership, I think, was a factor that myself and Mr. Silverman assumed based on the affidavit that was initially presented by Mr. Pileggi in the tort case in which he was defending Jimmy's Grill. He presented an affidavit that actually indicated that Jimmy Tenenbaum was the owner of this facility. And so I think Mr. Silverman and I relied on that affidavit in the tort case with the assumption that Jimmy Tenenbaum was the owner as opposed
when
to the
operator.
When
you say presented the affidavit, it was Tenenbaum who swore that he was the owner when he was not. Is that correct?
He certainly signed the affidavit, yes, sir.
Well, to my question, which is why is it appropriate to serve the agent rather than to send the papers directly to the insurance company, you gave me a factual answer. That is a prior practice with no apparent objection by the carrier.
That's correct.
I'm looking for a legal home for that argument. You know, where does it fit?
Well, if you look at the agency agreement, certainly the carrier would be free to designate who can accept service of process, not service of process, but notice of claims. And in the agency agreement between the carrier and Callaway, there is a specific reference under duties and responsibilities that Callaway has a duty and responsibility to inform the carrier when they receive notice of litigations or claims.
But how can the insured benefit from that unless the insured is an intended beneficiary of that contract, which exists only between the carrier and the agent?
Well, I think it follows, again, the practice in insurance, and I cited the Appleman treatise on insurance practices that most people consider their neighborhood agent to be the insurance company. And in following that, that's the custom and practice that Jimmy's Grill followed with the previous lawsuit. And also, that's the acknowledgement that the agent gave us in a telephone conversation that they had received the pleadings from Jimmy's Grill in this matter and referred them to the carrier. In fact, I verified, or I acknowledged that in a letter that I sent to First Delaware.
Is your answer that based on the factual record, everyone, including the insurer, understood that that it would be okay for the insured to effect to give notice through the agent?
That's correct. To follow on that aspect, as it's been pointed out, there's some clear language in the agency agreement that imposes a responsibility on Callaway as to what they're supposed to do. Callaway did, in fact, at one point acknowledge that they had received this notice and sent it to the carrier. In trying to look at the total record, I think the court appropriately considered all the information that was available and made an appropriate decision as to notice, and then asked the jury to decide based on the factual dispute what information was accurate, and the jury made their decision that notice was given within the appropriate time frame, a restriction that the court had placed upon us.
Does this clear language that you refer to in the agency agreement really go beyond saying, should you get notice from an insured that they have been sued, it is your obligation to pass it on to us? Does it say more than that?
Well, I can tell you it would be easier to tell you what it says, Your Honor. And As I pointed out in the brief, Article 1 describes the relationship and doesn't address this issue. Article 2 is the authority, your authority, meaning Callaway, the broker, and duties. And there's a series of things that they're required to do: bind risks, collect premiums, pay expenses, use company forms, comply with rules, records keeping. And then there's a Section G, which is reporting and accounting. And under that, it first says that they have to report all insurance policies bound and accepted not later than a certain date. Under Part 2, it says, you will notify us immediately if you receive notice of any claims, suits, or losses under our policies. It goes on to describe the responsibility to cooperate in investigation, adjustment, settlement, and payment of claims, and assist us in collection of deductibles from insurers. Now, it continues beyond that to some other duties and responsibilities, but that's the Article 2 section of duties and responsibilities. I submit to the court that it's absolutely clear that the parties to this agreement, the insurance carrier and Callaway, the agency, understood that Callaway would be receiving notices of claims. They would be receiving notices of cases, and that they had a responsibility. Mr. Silverman acknowledges that he may have an action against Callaway for failing to notice them in this issue. So you can't bring them to task for failing to perform a duty if they don't have a duty to perform in the first place. And we submit to the court that it's absolutely clear that they had a duty and an expectation between the parties. Otherwise, there'd be no reason for this to be in that.
I assume you're correct. It's clear to everyone that should they get notice of a claim from an insured, that under that arrangement, they had an obligation to notify the carrier that they had gotten it, as opposed to just putting it in their top desk drawer and forgetting about it. That's fairly obvious. But the issue is, how does that transfer to the insured and say, you can ignore the terms of your policy with the insurer and not give the insurer notice at the address indicated in the policy if you are sued, and say it's nonetheless as a matter of law sufficient that you simply go to the agent and tell the agent, because were you to do so, the agent would be under an obligation to notify the carrier. That's fudging a bit with the contractual relationships, isn't it?
Well, I don't believe that it is.
Isn't the only public policy at work here the policy of grab all the insurance you can and make it applicable to an accident for the convenience of the insured?
I think the public policy is that this is a risk that Jimmy's Grill insured against, and they got that insurance policy through Callaway. They had a prior practice with Callaway of presenting those legal documents to Callaway to present to the carrier. The contractual relationship between Jimmy's Grill and the carrier
The basis for that in the record is Tenafloff's comment that it had happened in the past, and the adjusters guessed that that's how the carrier had gotten notice in the past.
And the statement from the representative from Callaway that they had received pleadings and sent them to the insurance carrier.
Did the trial court determine as a matter of law that it was sufficient notice that the papers be given to the agent? Or was that an issue that was given to the jury to decide ultimately?
The judge decided as a matter of law under the facts of this matter that notice to the agent was notice to the carrier for these facts.
And can you give us a case that says that's consistent with Delaware law?
Not on the insurance issue, not directly on insurance issue. Certainly in the agency aspect of it, an agent can have authority and apparent authority, and certainly the contractual relationship between the carrier and the agency suggests that the agency has that responsibility. In fact, it's clear under the terms of the Article 2 that that is their responsibility and duty.
Is there a case that describes the obligation in the terms of apparent authority?
Again, for purposes of insurance, I do not have a case to cite to the court.
I think one of the things the court may be having trouble with is that your argument, if I understand it correctly, is that, yes, the insured had an obligation to notify the carrier, but the insured didn't do that, and fortunately, the independent agent also had an obligation to notify the carrier. So since the insured didn't do what he was supposed to do under his contract, or it didn't do what it was supposed to do, we now can recover nonetheless, because it turns out that the independent agent also had an obligation to give notice and didn't. So I excuse my failing to comply with my contract by the fact that you didn't comply with your contract either.
I think if you look at it in the reverse, in 2004 as opposed to 1998, 1999, as these matters were progressing, you can certainly look at the case in that light, in hindsight. In the beginning of the case, though, you have the issue of Mr. Tennefoss's understanding that when he receives these documents, he turns them over to the broker, and the broker sends them to the carrier, and that was done. And nothing was ever said, no indication from either the carrier or the agent that is incorrect. It is a common sense agreement, because in the eyes of most individuals, and as verified in the Appleman Treatise, most people consider their agent to be their insurance company. In this case, the insurance company has changed their name or changed their company three different times. It hasn't changed where Mr. Tennefoss would get his insurance from. He still gets his insurance from Howard.
Was there any evidence, any factual findings or support for the idea that Mr. Tennefoss actually thought that the independent agent was the insurance company?
Yes, his deposition testimony and his trial testimony was that he understood that this was where he was supposed to notify the carrier.
No, that's not really my question. My question is a little bit finer point to it, which is I hear you when you say most people think that their carriers are the same thing as that their agents are the same thing as the carrier. Is there evidence that in this case, this insured actually believed that it was giving notice to the insurance company when it notified the carrier, the agent? I'm sorry, I'm making this worse than it needs to be. You see what I'm asking?
I'm not sure I understand the distinction.
Okay.
Mr. Tennefoss did testify that he thought he met his obligations to the carrier by delivering notices to the agent.
Okay, but he understood that there were two different entities, an agent and a carrier, and he thought it was okay to just tell the agent.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that question was ever presented to him as to some distinction between the carrier and the agent.
Well, then I'm confused, because you earlier stated, unless I misunderstood you, that it was the practice and the understanding of Tennefoss and Jimmy's Grill that when they delivered notice to the insurance agent, that the agent would then transfer it to the carrier. And that was also the insurance adjuster's guess, based on past practice. So the question comes back. Did Jimmy's Grill, Tennefoss, quasi-owner or not, depending on for what purpose he's making the assertion or denying it, did he know that the agent was distinct from the carrier and that the agent would pass the information on about suit to the carrier? Yes or no?
I don't think that issue was ever raised as a direct question to Mr. Tennefoss. My understanding of his testimony is that he understood that this is what his responsibility was under the insurance contract, is to take the documents and give them to Callaway.
So Delaware law should be that you do not have to look at the language of your contract. You can reach a separate understanding from your language in the contract that you signed and do what you want to do. And if there happens to be a relationship between that other third party that you do give notice and the carrier, you're absolved of not following the terms of your own policy and giving your carrier timely notice so an investigation of a claim can be made in a timely way and either defended, not defended, or paid expeditiously. Is that the public policy that you would have us advance today?
No, Your Honor, because I don't believe that's what happened with Mr. Tennefoss. I believe that the carrier and the agent had an understanding that was verified by their agreement that the agent would be receiving notice of claims, and that was the practice between Jimmy's Grill and the agent, and the understanding of the claims adjuster, Mr. McGowan.
The insurance contract, the basic insurance contract between the restaurant and the carrier did require that notice be given to the carrier. We agree on that.
That's general language, yes, sir.
But the basic insurance contract didn't say how notice should be given. That is, it didn't say notice shall be given directly to the carrier at such and such address.
My recollection is it says as soon as practicable.
But it didn't specify a mechanism.
No.
It would be a very unusual insurance contract when you say it didn't specify a mechanism. If there wasn't a clause that said, for all purposes in this contract, notice is to be sent to the company at X address. Doesn't it say that?
I haven't found that, Your Honor. What I have in the provision, the notice provision, is in the appendix. And basically, it says you and any other involved insured must immediately send us copies of any demands, notice, summonses, or legal papers received in connection with the claim or suit.
Well,
I'm not aware of any provision in the policy that tells you where to send that, Your Honor.
Can you state to me that you know, after reviewing the contract, that there is, in fact, no address in the contract designated as the one to which one gives notice to the carrier?
If Your Honor gives me a moment, I will actually review the contract.
Well, no. The question is, can you answer that or not?
I can tell you that I've read the policy a number of times. I do not recall a notice address in the policy.
Is the policy in its entirety in our appendix anywhere?
It is in my appendix, and it is, if you give me just a moment. So yeah, I don't believe it is in its entirety. I think it's Mr. Silverman's appendix, and I believe only a portion of it is in.
Well, maybe Mr. Silverman will have the opportunity to address that in his rebuttal.
I understand my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, if I might address certain specific things that the court has concerns or questions about. I cite the court to appellant's appendix A-21. And if the court would like me to wait until the court finds that, that would be fine.
Now just tell us what it says. We'll find it on our own.
That's fine. With response to the court's question as to how notice should be given, the duties of the insured are very specific, and I submit to the court very clear. It says that the insured must see to it, and I quote, you must see to it that we receive a written notice of the claim or suit as soon as practicable.
Does it say where? Address?
Does it say where in the particular part that we have?
Does it say where anywhere in the policy notice should be sent to?
Sir, because that particular subject was not ever an issue, we didn't...
Is that a yes or a no?
It's an I don't know, because we only have the one page that I've given to the court. It also says that the insured, as part of their duties and responsibilities, should take down where and when the occurrence or offense took place, the names and addresses of any persons or witnesses, the nature and location of any injury, and it must be brought to us. Now, with respect to further response to your question, Justice, I have to believe that the policy comes with an address. This is a local company that was in Smyrna, Delaware, has always been in Smyrna, Delaware, for all relevant times to this particular action.
Well, you may have to believe it, but unless it's in the record, I'm not certain we can believe it.
I appreciate that, and I understand that the standard on appeal. Also, I would wish that the court would understand that that was never a concern below, such that the defense from my counterpart was never, we never knew where to bring the papers. There was never a concern that was ever raised by my counterparts at any point in the long-standing nature of this particular litigation. My counterpart also was talking about the agency agreement, and I would appreciate it if the court notes page A82 of the appellant's appendix, because while my counterpart would like to take some advantage of the authority and duties of, that's the agency agreement, by the way, some authorities and duties, what we ought to be focusing on is exactly what the contract says, that is the agency agreement. The agency agreement spells out very clearly, You will act as our agent for those lines of insurance for which a commission is specified. That's what it spells out in terms of when the independent agent is an agent. And then Part B, first page of Article 1 says, essentially for everything else, status, you are an independent contractor. I'm not sure that that could be any more clear. Now, it's sort of interesting, and it appeared that the court started to focus on this, which is that my counterparts want to take advantage in something of a third-party beneficiary way of a contract to which they were not part of a relationship. The only contract that existed that involved them was the contract of insurance. Now, I want to make sure I'm clear in response to the Chief Justice's question about public policy. The public policy should be very clear and distinct. When there is a contract, there's no ambiguity in the contract. The contract is clear and simple. The terms and conditions of the contract must be followed. Otherwise, we get into a slippery slope. And why in this particular case should this court reverse? To avoid exactly the situation that brought us here today.
If you want to avoid this kind of situation, why doesn't your contract specify, do not take your papers to the agent that you bought this policy from? And it could say that in bold. Instead, send them to this address. That would take care of it.
It certainly would. I don't think the contract can contemplate every single circumstance, because when you look
But we're not talking about somebody who dropped it off at the corner drugstore. We're talking about somebody who brought it or allegedly brought it to the agent from whom he bought the policy.
That's true, and that's why that is specifically covered in the policy. When the policy says, bring it to us, it doesn't say bring it anywhere else. It doesn't say bring it to the independent agent. It says bring it to us, notify us, bring it to us in writing. Why? To avoid exactly what befalls the carrier in this particular case. And I would note that we're here because the carrier did not get the same benefit of the bargain that the counterparts got below, which is that the reason we're here is because my counterparts received a default judgment below because of a failure to respond by the restaurant, resulting in a judgment. In the declaratory judgment action, there's a default judgment. More than a year goes by, and my counterparts are able to vacate that. It's another issue where there doesn't seem to be an issue of fundamental fairness that was part of the appeal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Summer. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. We'll take it under advisement.
Please rise.